Welcome to Desert Island Tech, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology, where we talk to people with disabilities to find out how technology has shaped their lives.
Hello and welcome to episode number 3 of Desert Island Tech, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology, where we talk to people with disabilities about their life and the technology that shaped it. My name is Stuart Lawler. Great to be back with you as always. This week, we're talking to Nina Chesworth, who joins us on Zoom. Nina, good afternoon and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Stuart.
Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you got in touch with the show. You sent an email. I think after hearing the first podcast and kind of said, I'd like to talk on this show.
Yes. Yes, I tuned into the first episode. It was very good.
Okay, and you wanted to tell your story and talk about the technology you use, isn't that it?
Yes. I'm kind of on a mission at the moment to share with the world my journey and kind of put myself out there a little bit in the hope that I will help others.
All right, well, you've come to the right place to do it. I'm really looking forward to this chat because it's really nice when people actually get in touch themselves and say, hey, I'd like to share something. And this is certainly part of what this podcast is about. Let me just before we go right back, and we're going to go right back to pretty much the time you were born in a sec. But before we do that, we're living in a hugely strange time. How have you been for the last couple of months? How are you doing? How are you keeping?
Ups and downs. It's difficult because my life changed so much 2 years ago, and then it's kind of changed again more recently, obviously, with everything and the situation we're in. Finding it difficult to kind of get back to, on track with my independence, getting out and about. That's the main challenge at the moment, because support for that has kind of dwindled with everything, with lockdown, and which is understandable, but obviously family support weren't able to help out as much at the start. So yeah, kind of ups and downs with it at the moment. It's very different.
I think it's really interesting because I think some of us who would have said very independent before the pandemic and then haven't been out for a while, sort of find it a little bit tricky just to get back up and running again, because so much has changed, hasn't it?
It has, yeah, definitely. It's just scary to go out at the moment, in the sense of, not scary, but just you don't know how people are going to approach you as well as you approach them, and, you know, you don't want to get into trouble, and the social distancing thing. There are so many different levels and things that we have to deal with prior to the pandemic, and now we've kind of got the pandemic on top of that as well. Mm-hmm. A few more challenges thrown in.
Okay, loads of challenges, and they're going to be around for a little while, but we can only do what we can, and I suppose take it in small steps and do what you're comfortable
with.
Yeah,
that's it. And the people make adaptations to help to solve that. You know, the RNIB's got a campaign, the council reassessing their sensory rehabilitation and things like that. So the people are definitely helping. So it's positive.
Okay, Nina, let's find out a little bit about you. My geography of the UK is hopeless. So tell us first of all, where are you in England?
So I live in Manchester. So it's the northwest of England.
All right. So we tune into Coronation Street. You'd hear that kind of accent. Is that right?
Okay. That's right.
All right. Fair enough. And just if you don't mind me asking, in relation to your sight loss, are you totally blind? Have you low vision? Where do you stand on all that?
I'm totally blind. I say I'm totally blind. I have a little bit of light perception in the left eye, but the right eye is artificial.
Okay. I want to go right back to, I suppose, the early days when you were born. And was your vision always at that level, or had you?
No,
had
it's you a more? Bit of a it's a bit of a story.
Okay.
So I was born sighted, up, and I had full vision till the age of 2 years of age. I caught the flu virus and it attacked my eyes, and then it burnt itself out and then just kind of left me with different conditions, which at the time they didn't know what they were because there was nobody else. I think there was maybe two other people in the world that had the same thing. So it's quite rare. And that caused me to have very low vision, very blurred vision. So from the age of two, right up until the age of about 28, I had several surgeries to try and rectify it. I think the closest that they came to with all the research and the prodding and poking was chronic uveitis, and I had cataracts, and during two of the surgeries I had a lens transplant as well on both eyes.
You've been through the mill then in terms of surgeons, yeah. Right? You know what those theatres are like only too well.
I do.
what was school like then? Because you were, I sometimes think, and just from chatting to other people as well, mm-hmm. low vision is so much harder. It's far less black and white than total mm-hmm. blindness. You know, when you're blind, there are X amount of things you can use and do. Mm-hmm. When you're low vision, there are so many more variables. What was that like for you?
It was challenging. I think throughout primary school, I went to a special primary school for blind and visually impaired children. And they don't do that anymore. I think they just have departments within schools now. But when I was at primary, it was okay because they had, the teachers were very aware of our disabilities. They had the right equipment. They had the right support there. It was only when I went to high school, so I went to a mainstream high school because that's where my family went and I wanted to be with them and to be as normal as I could, if what you could call normal, you know. It's, so I wanted to go to the high school they went to. So it was only then really that I started noticing the challenges that came with low vision and the different things that I had available to me or not.
So how would they have manifested themselves? Was it, for example, a lack of technology? Was it things like, you know, not being able to see the blackboard, or was it more some of the social stuff as well?
Well, in going to the high school that I attended, I was the only pupil with a visual impairment. So the staff weren't very aware of what was available. I had a support worker that came in from the council, and I got the usual magnifier. They were told to enlarge all copy, you know, to bigger font size, just basic stuff, really. And I think because I was the only pupil with the sight loss, I think they found it quite difficult to know what was available for me, which in turn, because I didn't know what was available either, and I was fighting against my sight loss, I didn't really want it. Mm-hmm. So,
what sort of, if you don't mind me asking, just so we can get mm-hmm. a sense of what time are we talking about? Is this like, you know, roughly how many years ago, so that we can get a sense of, for example, what technology was available at the time?
So high school, I was probably around like from 11 to 16. So I'm now 38. Okay. So my math is 25 years ago.
Okay, so there was certainly some technology available. Yeah. Certainly not to the extent there was now, probably not the same amount of funding.
No iPhones,
right. No. Large CCTV devices that were not very portable. Okay.
Like with the monitor and the camera, and even the handheld magnifiers weren't, like now you get them little pocket size ones. I remember being a teenager in the middle of the class and having this big A4 size magnifier that covered the whole book. And when you're trying to be discreet about your sight loss and wanting to just be included with the class, and you've got this in front of you, this big piece of equipment, it's hard not to stand out, which was a struggle in high school.
Talk to me about what happened after school then. You finish your finals, your school exams, your A levels. What happened after that?
Yeah, so I, with my GCSEs, I, in high school, I kind of found my comfort in art and being able to be expressive, because it wasn't so much about having to read text and be on computers for a long time. So I found that that was helpful for my sight as well. It didn't put too much pressure on my eyes. So finding my way into the art and design kind of world, I went on to college and then on to university studying art and design.
Now I'm just curious, because and you're not the first person, by the way, with low vision who's done this. I know that, and I know lots of people have done it, but it's an inherently visual world. And it's very lots of stuff going on there. What was that like?
Challenging. It was, as I got older, the support got better, the technology got better. By the time I got to university, Apple was becoming a big player. I still didn't have the iPhone and things like that, but they were using iMacs at university. The accessibility wasn't like it is now on Apple products, but it definitely helped a lot more at university by that point. I don't know. I kind of guess I broke everything down into sections in a way, I suppose, took a little bit at a time. And then kind of, as I broke it down, then just went with the flow and I guess the creativity. And just allowed myself to just put down what I thought I could. Not too much pressure.
And I suppose, because at this time you still have, okay, you have low vision, but clearly you have workable vision because you're doing art and you're in this, as we said already, visual world. Was things like navigating, you know, things like mobility, they were all okay for you then, were they, at that point?
Yeah, at that point I still had my two eyes working. I'd had corneal grafts. So I had two corneal grafts on both eyes. I had the lens transplant. So whilst the grafts were working, my vision was very clear. I still had to use magnification to read any books. But at that point, it was just a little handheld magnifier. So it was quite easy. And then once a cornea ejected, that's when the sight started to become foggy again. This luckily didn't happen during university. I managed to get through university without the graph rejecting. I think it was towards the end that it started to reject, and then my sight started to get foggy, and things did get difficult. I didn't, unfortunately, looking back at it now, I didn't get the support or ask for the support that I probably was entitled to. I kind of just fought my way through it and kind of thought, I'll be fine, I'll get through it, which is one of my regrets in life, but I still got my degree. So
absolutely, and well done, because it must be a really frightening experience. You're coming to the end of a big chapter in your life. You're you know, because we all, when we get to the end of our university, we're starting to think about the next chapter, which is work. But in the midst of all this, you're dealing with a potentially serious degree of vision loss, which is no doubt going to impact and impede that search for work. What was kind of going on? Because were you in and out of the hospital at this stage? Were they trying to see, could they save what they could?
Yeah, so once I left university, I didn't think really about what work I was going to go into. My career kind of took a back burner. I was working in bars at the time throughout uni to keep the bills paid. So I just continued with bar work, really. And even though my sight was deteriorating, it's a handy trick that I've learned over the years to develop. And I find that our memory is really good. I'm very good at looking like I'm okay because I memorize things and where things are. So when I was working in the bars, I couldn't see what the buttons were on the tills or what they said, but I memorised them, went close to them, memorised every button and then knew what I was doing. So I got very good at just doing that, really. So, yeah, my career took a bit of a back step to my sight, which was kind of worrying at the time, but obviously wanting to get that clear vision back was the main priority.
Sure. So I suppose you're kind of saying, look, let me get my sight sorted first, then I can work on the career. Let me get my eyes to a point where they're stable. So what happened? Because it didn't stabilize then, didn't?
No. As I'm still getting to the point now where I'm hoping the career will follow. So from leaving university, I had a second, well, I had a corneal graft. I went down to Moorfields Eye Hospital in London under a specialist, and he'd done a corneal graft, and it was a trial basis with immunosuppressant drugs. So I was the first one out of maybe, I think it was 8 at the time, that tried this approach. And after having 5 corneal grafts previous to this one, they always rejected. So I always went through the clear vision, then back to the cloudy vision. And then I had this one in London with the immunosuppressant. And it was the first time in my life that I could read a newspaper.
Wow.
Without a magnifier. So it was a very exciting time. And that was great. I was on the recovery from that. I got a job then, full-time job, and thought, this is it. I'm kind of getting into the world now. And unfortunately, it wasn't meant to be. The universe had different ideas. And I had an accident in that job at that workplace. And something fell on me and it burst my eyeball.
Oh, my God.
The one that I had the operation on. So the one with the successful surgery.
So you've had this successful surgery. You've been reading newspapers, but you're on top of the world, mm-hmm. getting a job, and then almost this freak thing happens.
Yes,
and impacts the okay. So I don't know how anybody kind of recovers from that or moves on. Presumably,
I think sheer determination.
Yeah.
I've always been a kind of, well, my mum would call it stubborn, but I would call it determined. I've always kind of pushed myself to, I think it's that passion, that strive to just be a part of the world, I suppose, no matter what. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, what ability you have, you just need to, I definitely for sure just wanted to be a part of the world and be happy and move on. So, and a friend recently said to me that I have great resilience. So I'm just saying, well, I'll carry on my story and maybe you can decide at the end.
But so just bring me to the point there where you've had this accident in work. You're presumably back in hospital. They're looking at the damage, and I imagine they say, Nina, I'm sorry, but this can't be repaired.
Yeah.
So
told me they couldn't save the eye.
Okay. You're lying there thinking, yesterday I was starting, I was in this job, my life had changed, I'd done this trial. Now they're telling me, and it's in which, to be quite honest, which is this horrible, cruel, you know, twist of fate. Mm-hmm. They can't do anything. How do you mentally recover from that? What was going through your head as you lay there, these doctors telling you that this is the future for this eye?
It's funny because I didn't cry. I've cried since, but I didn't cry at the time. I remember being in the room and my family were all around me. My now husband, but boyfriend at the time, I'd only been with him 2 months, and he was there as well. So, and everybody around me was crying, even my doctor, even my specialist, she was crying. And I just didn't. And I don't know what it was. It was just kind of an instant acceptance. And then I think I just kind of latched then onto the left eye. And my thoughts were, well, it's okay because I still have my left eye. I can still see. It's fine. It doesn't matter if that one's not there. I still have my left eye. So, yeah, I think I kind of held on to the hope of that straight away. And that's what kind of got me through the next 12 years.
You're listening to Desert Island Tech, a podcast from Sight and Sound Technology.
You've come out of hospital. You have done serious damage to one of your eyes. The vision cannot be restored, but you're getting back on your feet. What happened next? This is an incredible story, by the way. what happened next? Tell us.
So this was 12 years ago when I lost the right eye. So within that 12 years, as I said, my boyfriend at the time, now husband, we kind of went on a bit of a roller coaster as well, because we'd only just met, and he had then a lot to take on, you know, not only my visual impairment, but then now looking after me and rehabilitating as well, and life change, I suppose. So we moved forward. We done a bit of traveling. We then decided to have my son, or our son, should I say, and I had Dylan. He's now nearly 10. So we kind of, decided to have my son, because I think my fear was of, now I only have one eye, that I didn't want to have a child when I was with no vision. Which, you know, looking now and experiencing the world of sight loss and the amazing women that do have children being completely blind, there's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that at all.
Yeah.
But at that time in my life, that fear was there. So we decided to have a child. And now, as I said, he's nearly 10. And so that took up about 5 years of my life.
We have a little guy at the moment who's almost 18 months, and he's at the point where if you drop something, if he feels like showing you where it is, he will. If he doesn't, he won't. So I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. You know, and he is my strength now.
Yeah.
I'll get to that as well. But he, as I said, that took up 5 or 6 years being a full-time mum. I just dedicated my life to him. And then it got to the point where he went to school, and then I was kind of right, okay, now what do I do? And by that point, I'd established a confidence with my left eye. I'd had a partial corneal graft. So instead of doing the full graft with my doctor in London, he decided to just do a partial one, which they'd done without general anaesthetic, which was a very, very strange experience. and had that one done, and that went really well because the vision had started to fog over again. So with this partial graft, it did clear the vision up again. So from that then, I decided I wanted to get back into my passion. And I must say, throughout the 12 years, the first thing that kind of gave me the confidence to get back on track and think about having a son and think about getting dressed in the morning, in a sense, was getting back into creativity. I remember my auntie, maybe a year or so after losing the right eye, my auntie took me to a bead making class, so making jewellery. And it was just that interaction again with that creativity, even if it was just making a basic beaded necklace. That really gave me the strength as well to move forward.
Were you using, if I may just for a sec, were you using mm-hmm. technology then during this time? You were operating with one eye. Were you sort of exploring back on the low vision tech trail, or were you kind of, because I'm sure at this stage you were seeing things like voiceover mm-hmm. on Apple on yes. phones, for example. Did that kind of stuff jump out at you? Did you kind of go, oh, this is going to be useful for me?
Yeah. So by that point, I had, I'd been introduced to the CCTVs, the desktop ones. So I had one of them. And I actually brought that with me to this jewellery course so that I could put the thread and the beads under the magnifier, and it would come up on the monitor. And going forward, I started making jewellery, glass jewellery, and that is how I managed to do it with this desktop magnifier. I also had a handheld pocket magnifier. I think it was the Olympus handheld. That's what it was called, the pocket magnifier. And yeah, as you said, Apple became a game player. I got my first iPhone and it had the inbuilt Zoom in their accessibility. So just being able, I remember when I had the first, when I lost the right eye and my left eye was still foggy, I was having to get people to read my text messages to me. And there was a, you know, few embarrassing ones in there that you don't want people
to read. Sure, we've all been there, yeah.
So it was such a relief when I got the iPhone and I could zoom in to the font and then read my own messages. And yeah, so technology has definitely helped pave the way for me.
So life at this point going pretty well, I gather. I'm kind of hearing from you. Your son is growing up. He's starting school. You're saying I better start doing something with myself. You're doing jewelry. You're making stuff. You've worked very creative ways to use low vision equipment.
Yes,
but you don't have any vision anymore. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. So from the making the jewelry, I decided then that I wanted to share with the world how creativity can be such a meditative practice and can help people through difficult times. So I wanted to be able to create a space where I could share that with the world. So I decided to mix my two experiences, so hospitality and creativity, and I opened a craft cafe in Manchester.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was the best 12 months of my life, I think. Well, 18 months with all the prep. And so basically I set up this business on my own completely from scratch, everything, website, name, logo. I designed all the logos and everything myself, opened, found a premises, done all the work to it. We opened up in, when did we open? March 18, we opened the cafe. And we were booked out every weekend for children's craft parties. I hosted adult craft and creative workshops in the evenings. You could come and get a nice slice of cake, a cup of hot chocolate. It was a lovely space. It was my dream come true because people were coming. There was a lady who was going through a very difficult time and she'd come every week and just have a coffee and just sit there for an hour with her baby just doing crafts. And it was kind of my dream came true. It was, I created this space and I don't know, the universe wants to set challenges as it does, I suppose, with most people. And one day I was at home and we were having a bit of a clear out because of the business and just trying to make space with stuff. And there was lots of things in my living room. And this one morning I was trying to do payroll. As I said, I'd done the whole business myself, which is another life lesson learned, not to try and do everything yourself. Because I was doing the payroll this morning and I was rushing about trying to get my son ready for school, do the payroll. I climbed over all the rubbish that was in the way, bent down to get something out of my briefcase. And there was a broken TV on the table and I basically headbutted the telly. And because of my right eye not being there anymore, the depth perception's out. And I kind of adjusted to that. Well, as I adjusted to it, everybody says that I'm clumsy, but it was because of my depth perception. But it was because I was rushing as well. And when I headbutted the telly, it kind of burst, it created a hole in the top of my eye. And then the retina came out of the hole from the back of the eye. And I'm sorry if this is a bit graphic. So I lost 95% of my retina. But when I was in that same situation again and I felt deja vu all over again, they did say to me that they had managed to save the eye this time, which was such a relief because I just kept thinking, well, the way that technology has improved just in my lifetime, surely technology will improve that much more, that who knows what might happen in the future. So please just save my eye so that something might be able to happen in the future.
What age was your little boy at this stage?
So he's 10 in December. He was eight. Yeah.
It's a huge thing for an eight-year-old.
He was actually in the house when it happened as well. Okay. So he saw everything. So
it's really, and I can only imagine how, and I'm sensing it's been very difficult for you to come on and have this chat, but mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are going to find this an incredible podcast.
I found the more that I talk about it and tell people the story, the easier it is.
So this was 2018.
Yes.
Okay. And we're now 2020. And of course, COVID has come and messed us all around. But before COVID, at the beginning of this year, let's say, where were you? I have a feeling anyway, whatever happens, and this, I don't think this story is over, because I think this story will continue long after this podcast, that we're going to hear all sorts of great things from you. Where were you at the beginning of the year in your plan? Because I suspect it was big.
Yes, since losing my sight, it's been an adapting time again. I think my life of varied levels of sight loss has prepared me for complete sight loss. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. so I'm kind of, adapted quite well to it. People say to me all the time, wow, I can't believe you're amazing. But I think because you're already in that mindset of having limited vision anyway, I think you just adapt to it well. So I had, since losing my sight altogether, I kind of got back into working with Henshaw's, volunteering for them. And I found a kind of gap in the market, as they say. There wasn't much support around for working age visually impaired adults, around 25 to say 65, that kind of, there was a lot of support for children and young adults, mm-hmm. and then over 65. Mm. So in Manchester, I didn't find, because obviously now being newly blind, it is different to being visually impaired. And I wanted to go and go to a group or support to find people who were the same that I could speak to my peers. And as much as everybody, it's lovely that there is that support for those other age groups. They just, if I'm telling them about my son playing Fortnite on his Switch and discussing how I can't engage with him about that, it's difficult when you're talking to a 70-year-old who doesn't know what a Switch is. Mm. So I kind of wanted to create that space then for people who were around the same age that could get together. So I set up a support and social group for that age group. And we were meeting once a month. We've got an online Facebook group, and we were meeting up once a month in the centre of Manchester. And that was going really well. And then COVID hit.
It'll come back though. I have no doubt it'll be back bigger and better.
Yeah.
There's people who will be listening to this that will really, and people like me who are kind of, as I say, seasoned blind people. I've been blind since mm-hmm. birth, and it takes a lot mm-hmm. to kind of make me think. But this really has, and I've actually found it quite difficult to do this interview. I think you found it incredibly difficult to do mm-hmm. it as well. But you have huge tenacity. Like, what's coming across all the time is, just something, I'm going to do it. So I'm going to set up the jewelry, and I'm going to do creative arts, set up the jewelry, then I'm going to set up this space for people 25 to 65 who just want to meet and get things off their chest. But were there days when you just said, I don't care anymore, let someone else do it, I can't keep going? You must have had those days where you just say, I can't, why me?
Yeah, of course I have them days. Especially I struggle a lot at the moment with getting out and about, because I used to be able to just, even though I had low vision, I could still go and walk to the shop to get a pint of milk or go to the cafe and have coffee on my own. I used to love my own space, and now it's so I can't do that because I'm only just starting to have the cane. Well, I had the cane training before lockdown, and lockdown happened, and so that stopped. So now I am again back completely reliant on family, my husband, even my son to an extent. I walk him to school, but it's kind of sometimes it feels like he's walking me to school as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, I do definitely have them down days, and I just don't want to leave the living room or get out of bed and just sit and watch the telly and cry myself to sleep. I still definitely have all of those experiences. The thing that I found in the last 2 years, and this is through having therapy, meditating, I've got into yoga, and I found that just accepting all of those feelings, whether they're good or bad, is what helps you get through every day. Because I remember in my teens and younger days, I used to fight against all of that. I used to, no, come on, you can't be sad, you can't show weakness, you pull yourself together, it doesn't matter, you can't do it, you've got to do it. Whereas now I don't push myself so hard, I allow myself to feel all of that. Have a down day, and then the next day you feel better.
Yeah.
You've got it all out of your system.
Sight loss is a journey, and I suppose for many people, they're on it for many years, and maybe you never quite come to terms with it, especially if you had a reduction in vision or a sudden loss in vision, or you know, this kind of gradual loss that's going on for a long time. What would you say to maybe, because I've no doubt there'll be people listening here who have been really taken by your story, but there are people who might be, because we've all found this whole lockdown period, we've mentioned already in this podcast, found it hard, it's been tough. But what would you say to people who are just struggling a little bit in general and not sure where to go, and this sight loss stuff is playing havoc with them?
I would say always talk to somebody, share how you're feeling, allow yourself to feel what you're feeling. You know, if you're scared or worried, allow yourself that, but then speak to somebody and ask for help, because help is always there. I wouldn't be where I am and be who I am if it wasn't for my friends and family around me and having that support. And even if you don't have that support network of friends and family and you live alone, reach out to a social group, reach out to a charity. You know, people are here to help, whether it be technology, social, emotional, we're here to help, and we can get through this together. We're all here together, we're all going through this together.
It's one of the well, there are some positives to COVID. There's been a few, but I think one of them is, and certainly I have witnessed it, and I've heard lots of people talk about it, is this thing of people have actually stopped to check in and just to chat to people and say, hey, listen, you know, okay, we can't meet online, but we're all going on Zoom tonight to have a glass of beer or whatever, you know, come on.
Yeah.
And people are ringing up just to say, no, I'm not ringing for any reason, just to check in. That's really nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful. It is really nice. I think we just need to check in more with ourselves and check in with others, definitely.
And there's a phrase that's been used for a while, and I think it's so important, be kind to each other. Just give everyone a little bit of space and we'll all be okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Nina, at the risk of, and I don't want to sound patronising, but I want to say that you've inspired me by just having this chat. It's been really great. And if you don't mind, I think it would be really interesting for us on this podcast and for our listeners to maybe check in with you in a year's time, bring you back, just find out how the year has been, see what you've made your first million at that point or something, you know.
Yes, fingers crossed.
So if you don't mind coming back in a year and talking to us.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Okay, I'm going to put a note in my diary today to get in touch with you in about a year from now, bring you back on the show. For the moment, stay safe. I know whatever you do, you're going to do amazing things. And thank you for your honesty and for just telling your story in such a beautiful way today. Many thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Stuart. Take care.
What an amazing piece there. Thank you so much to Nina Chesworth. I thoroughly enjoyed that chat. What an inspirational lady who's going to go very far indeed. That's just about it for this week's edition of Desert Island Tech, but we'll be back soon. In the meantime, stay safe and well, and talk to you then. Bye-bye.